Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Nun Pet Amud Aleph, 10 lines down. Yesterday, we discussed towards the end of the daf certain things that if an animal is impacted by them, which means that the animal somehow fell in a way that it wasn't a controlled type of descent, the animal fell on different items, and that has a different impact. Most of the items here are probably speaking about birds, because it's really not something that would affect an animal as much as a bird. But the concept being that what we discussed before about nafull, which is when an animal falls for more than 10 tefachim, that we worry about the damage to the internal organs, that a question applies not only to behemah, also applies to birds. And then with regards to birds, the Gemara was giving us all different scenarios, and then it gave a summary line to that, which is klala de milta. The basic principle is called midei de mishrik, anything that's like slippery or something that is not compacted, bo mishum risuke varim, then we don't worry about the inner organs being affected by it because it cushions the impact of the animal. And that lo mishrik, and then things that are not slippery, which means that it won't allow the animal to slide off of it, or it's compacted so that it doesn't have any give to it, bo mishum risuke varim. Then there's a serious question about the impact on the animal, and then we have to decide whether the animal is a treifa or not a treifa based on the tests that we saw yesterday. And then we have the case of davuk. Davuk, interestingly enough, sounds exactly like what it means, and Rashi brings over here, gluda. It's glue. You have a board that has glue on it, and Rashi explains over here, they used to put glue on a small piece of wood or on a small, smooth surface, ba'of shochen alav. And then when the bird goes to, on that board, on that glue, then he sticks to it, then he tries to fly while it's still attached to the glue there, and obviously it doesn't succeed, and then it falls down. And then the question is, this bird that's impaired because it's stuck to the glue board, what's the din of this bird? So today, in the modern day, they still use these as traps for mice and for rats. They're not exactly the most humane types of traps. But here, similarly, they were doing this for birds. It's an old-fashioned way of trapping the animal. And now, if a bird is trapped by a glue board like this, what is the din with regards to it falling? Because it cannot cushion its impact now when it goes and falls with the board. And so then, does that damage the bird's inner organs? Ravashi Shari, Ravashi says it's not a problem of nafull. Meimar Asar. Now the Gemara qualifies this. Bechad Gafa, if only one of the wings is attached to the glue board, then the Kuliyama lo plige du Shari. Everybody agrees that it's okay, because we assume that with the other wing, he's able to at least balance himself, give himself some sort of cushion before he hits the ground. He's able to control the landing. Ki plige betray gafe. Where they argue is when both wings are attached to the glue board. Madasar, the one who says it's problematic, amrlecha, heche nekum. What can he do? Rashi says, heche nukum, bamei yachol hakim. What can he keep himself up? Vilisa etatzmo. To carry himself. What is there that will allow him to launch himself or keep himself afloat, so therefore he's just going to fall like a rock, and it's going to be very impactful because he has nothing to cushion that fall. On the other hand, there are others who say, is how is he going to protect himself? How is he going to land? There was an alternate girsa in the Gemara also that similarly followed that type of view, which is that even forgetting that the fact that he can't fly, he can't keep his wings, but he can't control the landing at all. There's no way to control the way that he hits the ground, and therefore he's going to be injured seriously. Uman the Shari, and the one who says it's mutar, amalacha efsha de nikum aikve de gape, that he has the ability to move. Rashi over here says that it is the mimiksat hu nose et atzmo bikve akapaim, with the edge of the wings, burosha knaf, that is the edge shechotchim aknaf mina avaz, the place where you cut it away from the body. So the place where you cut the wing away from the body, over there, he still has some flexibility in that part of the wing. It's the ends of the wing that are caught in the glue board. But the front of the wing and the part that's attached to the body has some flexibility in the wing there, and that'll give him the ability to control the descent. He may not be able to fly, but he'll be able to control it somewhat, and therefore he'll land in a better way than that won't cause risuk evarim. So that's one version of the qualification. Ve'ike da'amre, the other version is, betray kape, kuleyama lo pligi dasir. Everybody agrees when both wings are caught on the glue board that there's nothing to do. Then it's clearly risuke barim because he has no way to control the descent, to cushion the descent. But the machloket here between Ravashi and Amemar is with one wing. Man dashari amar lecha efshar de parach v'chad gafa. The one who says that it is okay says that you can do something with one wing. That one wing can help you control the situation. It won't be balanced. It won't be exactly perfect landing, but at least you can control the situation and cushion the impact. Man dasar kevin de b'hai lo matzi parach b'hai nami lo matzi parach. Since he can't use one wing, the other wing doesn't function properly, and he'll just end up landing on his side or flipping over. He's not going to be able to do anything, control the descent, and he's going to have a hard landing. V'hilchata. The halacha is b'terei gapei asir. That's the chumrah, meaning that out of the two lishonot, the one that's the chumrah says that by two wings attached, everybody agrees that it's asur. There we paskin it's asur. B'chad gapa, in the one wing, we paskin d'shari. Even though technically it would be the chumrah, but here, if you take the first lashon, everybody agrees it's mutar. And if you take the second lashon, Rav Ashi, who is one of the batra and the morei halacha, he says it's mutar. So for that reason, we say that by chad gafa, if one wing's attached, it doesn't have a din of risuk evarim. Now, Rashi qualifies that and says, gape asur, elim ten amad v'alach. That Rashi says that the same qualifications that we have by beima, that has risuk evarim, or a fear of risuk evarim, where it had a hard impact, then if the animal gets up, then it's okay to shecht right away, but you have to do a bedika. Rashi believes the reason they have to wait the 24 hours is because the risuk evarim is an indiscernible treifa, and there's no way to determine whether it's a treifa or not. On the other hand, the Rambam believes that you can see the treifa, you can see the risuk evarim, but it's only manifest after the 24 hours. So you have to wait the 24 hours in order then to check whether there was risuk evarim. Before that point in time, it's not discernible. Rashi says you can't check at all because it's a halacha l'moshe misinai, and there's no discernible way to tell if there was or wasn't any risuk evarim over here. Once you cross over the 24-hour period, you're outside of that geder of treifa, and then you have to do checks to determine whether there was other damage there. According to the Rambam, you have to do checks then to see if there was risuk evarim, because now it's discernible after that 24-hour period. And the Baha'i claims that in those cases where you do require a check, it has to be over the next 12 months. If 12 months have passed already, it already has extricated itself from the world of treifa, because the treifa is only chayif v'shnei masar chodesh. So once you even cross over that threshold, then you wouldn't need a bedika if the animal had such a chavata, then it got up afterwards and didn't walk. That does require a bedika, but that would only be for the next 12 months. If you shechted it after that point in time, you wouldn't require a bedika.
If it walks, then you don't even need to do a bedika.
And even in situations where we say ein choshishim, or we say that there's no problem of risuk evarim, the Ramban believes over here that there's still a necessity to check for other types of trefot that could happen because of the impact or because of the fall.
So Rashi quotes the Baag, Kohechi debayi bedika. Anytime you need a check, kagon nifula, shvura, udrusa, dimitkashre bedika, that the Gemara says that these are problems and you have to check it. And if you check it, then it's okay. Hani mile bedorot kamai. Baag says that's in the earlier generations. Debikiv the mibdak. They were experts at checking these things. Va'ana lo bikiin, below samchinin an option. We don't have that type of expertise, and we don't rely on ourselves to be matir in these situations. So the Baha'i basically shuts down the possibility of doing a bidika anymore. All these items that require bidika, that we no longer have that dispensation available to us because we're just not experts enough, we're not qualified to do the check. And Rashi says something incredible. He says, "V'lid nira, deinlo the dayan al-mashe navrot, umutali smokhalav." He says that that's what the Torah says. Every dayan in his generation is the mora halacha for that generation. And just because we're not like the people before us, doesn't mean we don't have a right to paskin. Whoever the shofet is in that day, he's the shofet. That's what you have. Yiftach bedoro, kishmuel bedoro. That's what they're actually quotes from Chazal, that Yiftach and his generation has the same status as Shmuel and his generation. Of course, Yiftach and Shmuel were worlds apart. Nevertheless, they have the same status in their generation as being a shofet. And so over here, Rashi says, just because we don't have the expertise that the former generations have, doesn't mean that we can't paskin, that we can't do the bedika. We have to do the best we can do in those situations. Aval, hu yizaher yafeh. You got to do this in a very careful and controlled manner. Ulavil vanav kol atabachim. You got to bring all the butchers in town. V'chol abikim bedavar. And all the other experts. You can't just rely on yourself. You need to bring in other people to help you with this. so that you will come to the right conclusions. Rashi says, we can't do it as individuals anymore, but maybe more on a consensus basis. If you bring in all the experts, you bring in all the people who are qualified here, that we could do a bdika. But it's very interesting that Rashi is unwilling to accept this idea that a path or an option that halachically is available to us would be shut down just because we're not experts or we just don't have those qualifications. Rashi says this is Torah Shabbat. This has to do with the Shoftim Asheyeh B'Yamim Ahim. And therefore we're qualified as little as we are or as unqualified as we are. We're qualified because we are the Shoftim B'Yamim Ahim. Very amazing Rashi, but does give a certain amount of empowerment to say that even if we're not as great as the previous Torah nations, even if we don't have those insights, we still have to carry on. We still need Pesach Halacha. We still need to exercise that right of the Shofet. All right, Nishtabru Rov Tzalotah. So one of the Trefot in the Mishnah was if the majority of the ribs were broken. So as far as the ribs of the animal are concerned, they have on the two sides of the animal, there are 13 ribs on either side of the animal. The Gemara is going to say that only 11 of those ribs there are relevant. How you break down which of those 11 ribs is relevant is actually based on a machloket between Rashi and the Beinu Chananel that we saw before. So we'll discuss it in a minute. Tan Rabbanan. Elohein Rov Tzlaot. What is the situation in which you have the majority of Tzlaot? Shesh Mikan v'shesh Mikan. You have 6 on each side. So 6 on each side is not the majority of 13. It's clear that they think that there's 11. 6 is the majority of 11. And so they're only looking at 11 of those ribs. 6 out of those 11 ribs is broken on both sides. Then you have Rov Tzlaotah. Then you have the majority of the ribs. O achat esre Mikan v'achat Mikan. Or you have 11 ribs broken on one side and one rib on the other side. Rove can happen in two ways. It can be rove of both sides, or it can be rove of the total. So either you get 6 on each side, which is a rove of each side, or simulate the same effect by having 11 on one side, one on the other side, which is 12 ribs, which is a majority of 22. So it's a lo zuavzu. Not only in the case where you break 6 on each side, is it true, but even in the case where you break 11 on one side and one on the other side, that's still called rove tzalutah. Amar Ziri. Rabbi Ziri says, Umechatzian klape shidra. It's only true with regards to the breaking of the rib towards the upper half of the rib. So if the ribs are broken from the halfway point and down towards the sternum side, that's not an issue. It's only when the ribs are broken towards the spinal side, Mechatzian ulamalo, that's where this becomes a problem. That's where it becomes an issue of a trefa. So now the Gemara qualifies this and says, Amar Rabbi Rachana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ubitzlaot, Gudolot, Sheish Ben Moach. And here we're only speaking about the large ribs that have marrow inside of them. So here's already the qualification where some of these ribs are getting left out, which is it's only the ribs that have marrow inside of them that count. And therefore, the ribs either don't have marrow or maybe are softer ribs don't count towards this rib count. We know that already because we know there are 13 ribs on each side, and the Gemara is clearly saying that 11 is the count. So 2 of the ribs are getting left out because either they lack marrow, or for some reason they are softer. So now the question is, which of the ribs is this referencing to? It actually is connected to a machloket that we saw back on Mem Hei, which was, what is the chazeh? What is considered to be the chest of the animal? That was with the question of the matnot kihuna. What is that chazeh? So we spoke about it being the front of the animal, the neck of the animal, including the first 2 ribs. Over there was a machlok between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Chananel. Rashi said the first 2 ribs means 1 rib on each side. That's the 2 ribs, 1 rib on each side. That is what belongs to the chazeh, that belongs to the chest. So that means the first 2 ribs on the front of the animal are not considered a part of the rib line. They're part of the chazeh, they're part of the chest of the animal. On the other hand, Rabbeinu Chananel over there said that the chazeh, when it says shtayim, means shtayim mikan or shtayim mikan. It means 2 on each side. So that means that the first 2 on each side are part of the chazeh, meaning that first 4 ribs are included in the chazeh. So that would be the, according to Rabbeinu Chananel, it's pretty straightforward, that when we're speaking about here, there are 26 ribs, and only 22 of them are relevant to this din. It's the first 4 ribs towards the chest that don't count, because those 4 ribs are a part of the chazeh, they're part of the chest, and they don't count towards the ribs, and then the 11 we're speaking about are the 11 ribs from beyond that to the end of the animal. According to the Rabbi Yonatan Milunil, it's the first 2 ribs that don't count, which would be similar to the view of the Rabbeinu Chananel, that the first 2 ribs are a part of the chazeh. Whereas according to the Rashba, it's the two at the end that are cut off because they are much smaller and softer ribs. And therefore, it's the last four ribs at the tail end that are cut off.
Because the latter two ribs are either softer or don't have marrow in them. And that's why the ribs on each side are excluded. And according to the way that you would learn in Rashi and many of the other Rishonim, who says that the first rib on each side is part of the chazeh, then the subsequent 11 ribs are a part of the ribs that matter here. And then the last rib on each side is also not included in the count. So in support of Rashi's view, you're telling us that when you take out the rib cages and you're cutting them out, that the first rib and the last rib detach easily from the rib cage. And that you don't need a saw or you don't need something significant to cut them off. So the ribs at the end, the tail end of the animal, don't have marrow in them. They're smaller. They're not as large as the other ribs. And therefore they're not counted in the rib count. The first two are out because they're part of the chazeh. And the back two are out because they don't have marrow in them. Now, Ulav quotes from Ben Zakkai. It's interesting over here. Rashi says, Lo yadan amanu. We have no idea who he is. His quote is called Ben Zakkai. Now we have Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai. But he's called Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai. He's not just called Ben Zakkai. We're not certain as to who this Ben Zakkai is. Nekru b'rov tzad echad, nishtabru b'rov shnei tzadim. So here he used two different words. He used the word nekar, which means uprooted. Nishtabru means broken. So he's telling us now that the being nekar is more significant than being broken. So you're going to need more to be broken in order for it to be a problem. Versus nekar, you have a less of a standard. So six of them are nekru. Then that's enough to make it into a trefa. If it's nishtabru, if they're broken, the ribs, then you need a rove on both sides. You need the six on each side in order for it to be a trefa. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, on the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan says, ben nekru, ben nishtabru, rove shnei tzadim. Rabbi Yochanan says, we never see any qualification like that. The Mishnah says, rove tzalotah. Doesn't matter whether it's nekar or nishtaber. Doesn't matter if it's uprooted or it's broken. Either way, it still needs the rove on both sides in order for it to be a trefa. And again, robe on both sides doesn't necessarily literally mean robe on both sides, but you need 12 ribs, not 6 ribs. And that 12 can be distributed either on both sides or on one side plus one from the other side. I'm a Rav. So Rav gives us din over here that's going to preoccupy us now for the remainder of this amud. If you have a rib that's taken out with the vertebrae with it, trefa, then it is a trefa. And even though, in general, the trefa is only in a situation where the spinal cord itself is snapped or broken, here where you have a ribs or a large number of ribs taken out, or you have parts of the vertebrae that are taken out, we expect that that's going to have an impact on the spinal cord. Either it's already had an impact, or it will have an impact because of that lack of protection in that area. Amri le Rav Kana Ravasi the Rav, so he's Talmidim. Rav Kana Ravasi say to Rav, if the tzela were uprooted, meaning that they are cracked at the chulya level, the difference between nishtabru is when the rib breaks in the middle of the rib. Nekra means that it's from the point where it's attached to the vertebrae, that's where it's cracked off. So now if you have nekra on both sides, but the chulya is still intact, what is the din? So Amar Lahu, he says back to them, gistra kamritu? You're speaking about an animal that's sliced in half. This has reverberations of what we saw earlier in the Masechta, which is that Shmuel says with regards to a gistra that it's a nevela right away. I mean, that's an automatic nevela. And that's how Rashi says it over here. You're asking me about a trefa? Gistra kamit? Ha nevela nami. That's even a nevela. So the question is, what was this interaction that happened between the students and Rav? And how does that influence what we think Rav said? Rav at first said, nekra tzela v'chulya ima. That you have the tzela with along with a part of the vertebrae. That makes it into a trefa. They ask him, if you have both ribs missing, but the vertebrae is intact, then that's the din. He calls it a tenvela. The vaha, Rav, nami, gistra, kamar. So then, why isn't Rav also speaking about a gistra? Because, as Rashi notes over here, kevin de nekar, tzela, v'chulya, if according to Rav, what happens is that the rib breaks away with the vertebrae, what's happening with the other rib? The other rib has nothing to hold on to. So by definition, what Rav said is that, if you pull away a rib and a chulya, then you've lost both ribs. So if Rav is telling them when two ribs are missing and the vertebrae is intact, that that's a nevela, then certainly in the case where both ribs and the chulya is missing, it should be a nevela. So why is he calling it a trefa? That's the way Rashi frames the question. My answer is, Kiyama Rav, tzela below chulya. No problem. Rav, when he said nakar, meant the rib was gone, but the vertebrae was intact.
Rav says, but that's very interesting. But Rav said, Vatzela v'chulia kamar. He was pretty explicit. He said, Nekar tzela v'chulia ima. That the chulia went with the tzela. Tzela v'chatzi chulia. It's a case where the rib went and half of the vertebrae went with it. Michlau. From there you would have to infer, if Rav Spim had a case where you have a tzela and half a chulia gone, Michlau, the Rav Kana Rav Asi, tzela below chulia amre. But they say their case is a case where both ribs came off, but the vertebrae is still intact. Vamarlu, gistru kramitu? And then he says to them, you're talking about a gistra, something that's an avela? Va amar ula. Ula said, ben zakai amar, nekru b'rob zarechad, nishtabru b'rob shnei tzadim. Didn't Ula say that ben zakai's position was that if they were nekru, that if they were broken the vertebrae, then you need rob zarechad. You need a minimum of 6 ribs for that. Nishtabru, if they're broken, you need brokerage snakes that they meet on both sides. If you're telling me that the meaning of Rav Kahana and Rav Asi's statement is Nekru means that they were broken with the vertebrae intact, isn't that exactly the case of Ben Zakkai? Ben Zakkai already told us when it's Nekru, you need rope. You need a majority of tzlaot. So how can Rav be telling Rav Kahana and Rav Asi, oh, if you have 2 ribs that are broken off Nekru, that's enough? You need 6, a minimum of 6. Amalah Chotam, Zesh Lokenegetzeh. Wait a minute. How do you know that the case by Ben Zakkai were ribs that were opposite each other? Maybe those were ribs that don't have the other side with the rib broken off. Hacha zekenegedzeh. Over here in the case of Rav Kahana and Rav Asi, it was where the ribs were on the opposite each other. There'd be 3 different dinim over here. There's the din at this point of Rav, where Rav says that if you have nekar, the rib, plus half of the chulia, that's a trefa. If you have 2 ribs that break off on a single vertebrae, on both sides of the vertebrae, the ribs are totally broken off up to the chulia, that's a nevela. In a case where you have the ribs that are broken at the chulia, but there are no 2 ribs opposite each other, then you're going to need 6 for it to be a trefa. And that's how we'll reconcile everybody's opinion. Gemara says, the only problem with that is, Bama Rabbi Yochanan. Didn't Rabbi Yochanan say, Berov Shnei Tzadim? Rabbi Yochanan disagreed with Ben Zakkai. And Ben Zakkai would say there's a difference between Nekru and Nishtabru. Rabbi Yochanan blurred that difference and said that doesn't matter. Whether it's Nekar, whether it's Nishtaber, you need a minimum of 12 ribs for it to be a problem. And Uberov Shnei Tzadim, when you have a minimum of 12 ribs, if Shard Lokaim Achad Minai Uzek and Egedzeh. By definition, if you have 6 on either side, then you have at least 1 rib that's opposite the other rib. Because there are only 11 ribs on either side that make a difference. If 6 on one side, 6 on the other side, one of those ribs has to be opposite the other side where it's broken because there's an overlap. There's not enough ribs to give you 6 and 6 and not have anything opposite each other. In addition, even if you make it that you have 11 on one side, there's still 1 on the other side which has to match up with that 11 to make it 12. So by definition, if you have 12 ribs, there's at least 1 vertebrae that has ribs broken off on both sides. Now, the easy answer to that question is to say that Rav is holding like Ben Zakkai. And not like Rabbi Yochanan. So that would be the easy solution to the problem. The Gemara does not offer that solution. It's clear that the Gemara thinks that either Rabbi Yochanan's position is halacha, and therefore they want to match up Rav and his Talmidim into Rabbi Yochanan's Shita, or, the way the Ramban phrases it, the Gemara didn't want to create a machloket that is so far apart, which is that Rav is saying now, if you have a chulia with ribs broken off on either side, that that is a nevela, and Rabbi Yochanan is saying that that's kasher. Until you have rove of the ribs gone. That's an extreme opinion to have a machloket. Generally, the Gemara tries to narrow the scope of the machloket into something that is smaller in nature to have their agreement over the greatest part of what they're discussing. Over here would create a machloket that is extreme, which is that one says it's an avela, not even a treif, but an avela, that's Rav, and then Rabbi Yochanan would say it's kasher. That's pretty difficult to swallow that their machloket would be so extreme. So because of that, the Gemara is trying to reconcile Rabbi Yochanan with their position, and if that's the case, we can't do it. So the Gemara answers, Hatam buchna below asita, hacha buchna v'asita. It depends on how it's cracked off. Now, buchna, the Gemara uses this type of expression in other instances. For instance, we saw this by the hip joint. The Gemara also said there was a buchna over there, which is a ball and socket joint. So the hip is a ball and socket joint. And the Gemara uses buchna, which is a pestle, meaning that when you have the mortar and you have the pestle is made up of a handle, a line, and then there's a ball at the end of it. And you use it in the pestle to crush inside a mortar, and that's the equivalent of like a ball and socket joint. That's how the Gemara describes a ball and socket joint of the hip. Over here, the Gemara is giving a similar type of description about the ribs' connection into the vertebrae, which is that they are a buchna ve'asita. Asita is like a tzalachat. It's like a sort of plate or bowl, somewhat equivalent to like the pestle and mortar look. It's not as deep as a balansaka joint, but they're suggesting that the ribs connect into the vertebrae in that way. So what they're suggesting is that the ribs at their end have a wider end to them, like a ball at the end of the rib, and that ball is attached or sits inside of the chulia. The truth is that it's very close to that. It's not actually in the chulia. It actually sits in between the two chuliot, which is between every two vertebrae. The ball sits there, and then it has two wings into which the rib connects that it locks into. So here's a picture of the vertebrae. The top of the rib has like a fork-like ball that comes out of it, and each one of those balls inserts into a chulia because it's sitting between the two chuliot. And so then the right ball goes into the chulia that's on the right side, and the left ball goes into the hole that is in the chulia on the left side. And that way it's a buchna and a sita, which is that you have the thicker top of the rib that inserts into the holes of the chuliot, which is that the rib has that forked top that has a ball on each end of it, inserts into those holes or to the receptacles on the two vertebrae of which it's bridging. So that's this idea of buchna ve'asita. Now the Gemara distinguishes between the cases here. Hatam buchna below sita. In one case, it's the buchna is broken off, but not the asita, which means that the end of the rib is broken off, but asita, where it sits, is not broken off. Hacha buchna v'asita. Over here by Rav, it's a case where not only is the end of the rib, which is the pestle part of it, but even the mortar part of it, place where it sits in the vertebrae, that is broken as well. The rib, along with a portion of the chulia. And Rabbi Yochanan talking about when the tzela breaks off without the chulia. Rav speaking about where you have the rib come out with a portion of the vertebrae that's cracked out with it. Rabbi Yochanan speaking about where you have the rib coming out entirely from its base, including the thicker part, the ball top of it, really like a fork top that's thicker, that's come out, but it doesn't pull a piece of the vertebrae along with it. It leaves a hole behind because that's what it was covering, but it does not take a piece of the vertebrae along with it. So that'll make a difference now, because Rabbi Yochanan, who says in Hebrew, tzlaot, is in a case of nekril. When they're nekar, the ribs are out from their root, from their base, you need a rove of tzlaot in order for it to be a trefa. Rav is speaking about a case when you have a rib that is pulled out along with a piece of the chulia. So that's going to be a case of nevela. When you have a rib that's pulled out with a piece along with it, that's going to be a nevela if it's on both sides. If it's on one side, it's going to be a trefa, to which the Gemara is now going to ask. If you say that the case of Rav Asi and Rav Kahana was a case where the rib is broken off with a piece of the vertebrae, that's exactly Rav's case. Rav said that you have the rib out with a piece of the chulia. So now if you have a rib with a piece of the chulia taken off of it, then Rav Asi and Rav Kahana are asking the same thing. Nakara rib with a piece of the chulia taken out of it. And if you tell me that they're asking about two ribs, and he said it about one rib, then what's the question? If by one rib and a piece of the chulia is already a trefa, then why are they asking about two ribs and a piece of the chulia? There it's clearly going to be a trefa, and Rav even says it's a nevela. So Gemara says, lo shmiel lehu de Rav. They didn't hear Rav's din. Now that they don't know Rav's din, they need to ask a question. So the Gemara says, v'ilabai minei ked de Rav. So then why don't they just ask the question of Rav's scenario? They're asking a question about a rib with a piece of the vertebrae coming off of it. So they can pose the question in two ways. One is to propose it like Rav, which is to say it's one rib with a piece of the vertebrae, or it's two ribs with the pieces of the vertebrae taken off. Why did they pose their question with two ribs instead of with one rib? Let them pose the question like Rav's did. They said, we're going to ask one question, and then we'll know the answer to both questions. That is, had we only asked him about one, meaning one rib with a piece of the chulia coming off of it, if he passes that to trefa, which happens to be his position, then kosher kein tarte. Then we know that by two it's also clearly a trefa, maybe even worse. On the other hand, if he tells it's kosher, akate tarte kami bailan, then we don't know what the din is with regards to the two. He told us that a single one with a piece of chulia is kosher. Maybe with two it would not be kosher. Maybe it'd be a trefa. We wouldn't know the answer to the question. So better off to ask about two, and then from two we can then extrapolate the din to one. Gemara says you have the same problem in the other direction. Yochi ashtanami. The kol bai minei tarte, Then if they ask him about two ribs that are taken off with a piece of the chuya, hanicha yamarlu ksheira. If he takes it, it's kasher, koshchein kado. Then certainly with one rib with the piece off, that'd be kasher. The yamarlu treifa, which is what he's going to say, then akati chada mibailu. Then you still have a question about the one that's there. The Gemara says, sabre, imkein, mirtach karotach. If that was the case, Rab would get angry at them. Chada treifa, tarta mibai? If one is a treifa, you're asking him about two? That's a crazy question. Why are you asking me about two? One's already a treifa. Why are you asking me about two? The Gemara says, v'akam relay, below rotach. Didn't they say that to Rab, and he didn't get angry at them? The Gemara answers, came in to come out of the gistera kamrito. Since he said to them, that's an avela. Hainu ritche. That was his getting angry. Meaning that when he responded to them, they say we have two ribs taken off with the chuya, and Rab responds to them, you're talking about a gistera? That's an avela? That's Rab getting angry. That means that Rab's saying to them, why are you asking about this? That's not even in the realm of a question. That's already an avela. You should have been asking about one. And therefore they got their answer to both questions, which is both two and one is a problem. Just two is even a bigger problem. And that's Rab getting angry. So first of all, just midine musar, that here the Gemara expects Rab to get angry, or the students expect Rab to get angry. His getting angry means that he's saying, that's a gistera, that's an avela, right? He didn't get really angry at them. He just simply hinted to them that their question was, right, their question wasn't so strong that they should have been asking about one rib, not about two ribs. But that's as far as it went for him getting angry. That's the first thing. The second thing is, why don't you have the same thing in reverse? Which is, the Gemara just creates a solution in a single direction. It should have application in the opposite direction. Gemara says, they wanted to ask one question from which they'll get both answers. Gemara said in both directions it doesn't work. Because if you get one answer, we'll give you both answers. The other answer, you'll still be uncertain about the other case. So Gemara says, no, because if they asked it this way, Rab would have gotten angry. And that's what happened, he got angry. So they knew the answer to both questions. Why can't you say that in the opposite direction? Ask him about one, and then he'll tell you the din. If he tells you that one is a treifa, certainly two is a treifa. If you ask him about one, and one is kasher, and then two is also kasher, he'll get angry and say, why are you asking me about one? Ask me about two, that's also kasher. And he'll just have the same thing in the opposite direction, and through his response, you would know both answers. So why does the Gemara say it only works one way? So Rashi claims it's a halachic reason, which is that in this case, if they ask about two, and it's a treifa, and he really should have asked about one, there could be a halachic problem that would arise, which is that they would only give a psak of treifa by two, they would be machshir one. So in that case, Rav's going to get mad and tell them, listen, why are you asking about two? You should be asking about one, because you need to know that the din by one is it's also a treifa. On the other hand, if they asked about one, and Rav says it's kasher, and even two is kasher, Rav's not going to get mad at them, because what's the downside? The downside is that when it's two, they make it into a treifa? That's the chumrah. So we're not going to worry in a case where it's kasher that you're mitareif, that's the chumrah, that we're not so worried about. If you're machshir in a case where it's a treifa, that's a more significant problem. And so that's why Rav would only get angry if they asked the question about two, if one was also a treifa, because then there was a possibility to be machshir, and Rav wants to dispel that. Then if they were cast a case of one, and Rav was machshir, even though both were machshir, it would be kasher even if there were two, over there he says, okay, what's the worst thing? They'll have the wrong impression about two and think it's a treifa. Korban won't come out of that. Nobody's going to be eating treifa because of that. That's how Rashi structures it and says that's the difference between the way that you phrase the question. On the other hand, the Ramban disagrees and says that Rav would get upset in both ways. The difference has to be in the way that you phrase the question as to whether you should have known the other information. Which is that in a case where you ask about two, basically what you're saying is we know information about one, and we're making assumptions already. So that means that there's an underlying assumption. When you start with two, that means that you've already assumed what the halacha is by one. Because you're asking about two means you know whatever the halacha is by one. So that's what Rav would get upset about, which is that they made an assumption about one, and they went to two. Then if you start with one, and then you move to two, that doesn't make any assumptions about two. That's starting with the smaller one. And then it says that once we know the smaller one, then we can ask about the second one. But it doesn't make any assumptions. And so that's why Rav would get angry in the case where they asked about two, because that means they made an assumption about one. If you start with one, that's starting with the lower number, and then you build up to the two. So even if there was a din that they should have known that that's also kasher, then he's not going to get upset because they're doing it in a logical step method, and that's not something to get upset about. What you get upset about is when you ask about something which presumes or makes an assumption of fact, and that is maybe incorrect. And that's where Rav would get upset. So that's how the Ramban explains that difference. Amar Rabba Bar Rav Shila, Amar Rav Matna, Amar Shmuel. Now we have a statement from Shmuel, which again is going to occupy us now for a little bit. Nekra tzela meikara, if a tzela is broken off at the base. Rashi over here claims, afilu b'lo asita, even without a piece of the vertebrae with it. You look up in the Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam says, imai sita. Rabbeinu Tam disagrees and says that Shmuel over here is saying it's a rib that broke off at the base, like an asita, and that would be then like Rav's din. Rav said that's a treifa, and now Shmuel's saying the same thing, that it's a treifa. Rashi claims that Shmuel's even more machmir, which is that even in the case where the tzela breaks off without the asita, that's already considered to be a treifa. And again, then that would be against Rabbi Yochanan's position, the way we've explained it over here. Vigul golet shenechpesa beruba. We saw this already earlier. That's a skull that had heavy trauma, whether it means that according to some it was shattered, there are cracks in there, but the krum ha-moach was never punctured. So the bone is broken, but the membranes below it are intact. But it's shattered in multiple places. Some say it's crushed. And others just said that there was nothing wrong with the skull, but the head had suffered several heavy blows to the head, which is similar to the effect of a CT's problems with brain damage from it. That's a head that has had either severe blows, shattered, or been crushed in the majority of the area of the, call it the cranium over here, because the skull includes part of the bone that's towards the face. Ubasar hakofet rov hakares, and the flesh that covers the majority of the rumen, birubo. If it has a problem in a rove of it, it's a treifa. That is similar to what we said in the Mishnah, that if you remember, the underbelly of the animal extends all the way from the four legs of the animal by the neck, where it starts to go up by the neck, all the way to the hind of the animal. There's a portion of that area that the rumen covers. The part of the rumen that extends beyond the rib cage. So that part, the basar, is covering it. The underbelly of the animal is covering it. So that rove of the basar, ha-chufet rove ha-kares. So it's the part of the flesh, the underbelly of the animal, that covers the majority of the rumen, which extends beyond the rib cage. That piece of that flesh, if a rove of it is something missing from it, we'll see in a second what the problem is, then that's a treifa. So the three treifot that are added by Shmuel, additional treifot, and the Gemara is now going to discuss each one of them. Nekra atzela meikara, treifa. If a tzela is broken off from its base, that's a treifa. Reminu, is that really true? Kama chisaron bishidra. How much do you need to be missing from a spinal column in order for it not to be mitamei meit? One of the things that's mitamei meit for ohel is if you have the entire spinal column intact. So how much of it needs to be missing for it not to be classified as being intact? So Beit Shammai Omrim Shtei Chuliot, if two vertebrae are missing, that's enough to make it that it's not mitamei boel. Beit Hillel Omrim Chulia Achat, even if one vertebrae is missing, it's not mitamei boel. The Amar Reb Yehuda Amar Shmuel V'chein L'treifa. Shmuel himself says that's the same din by a treifa. So that if you're missing from a spinal column, you're missing one vertebrae according to Beit Hillel, that's already a treifa. According to Beit Shammai, it'd be two. And the question from that statement of Shmuel is that if it's already a treifa when you break off a rib, why is he telling you then when a chuliyah is pulled out that it's a treifa? It'd be al-chat kam v'kama. If a broken rib is enough to make it into a treifa, why do you have to tell me about a chuliyah that it's a treifa? That would be a kol shekein. And that's why the Gemara thinks that that must mean that he thinks that a broken rib is not enough to make it into a treifa. And that would be the stira in Shmuel's view. And that's what the Gemara comes to answer and says, no problem. That din of Shmuel doesn't contradict what he says over here. Hacha, our case is tzela below chulia. It's when the rib's broken off without any of the vertebrae. Hotam, the case there in the Mishnah in Olot is chulia below tzela. It's a case where the vertebrae is missing, but the ribs are intact. Gemara says, that's a very cute answer about bishlama tzela below chulia mishkachava. Obviously, you can have a case where one of the ribs is broken off and the vertebrae are still intact. Elo chulia below tzela, hecha mishkachava. If the vertebrae is missing, how are the ribs still attached? Meaning that the ribs are physically attached to the vertebrae. If the vertebrae is missing, the ribs are broken off. The ribs have nothing holding them anymore. How are they in place? Gemara says, bishilhei kaple, at the end of the loins, at the tail end of the spinal column, the spinal column continues and has vertebrae past the point where it has ribs that are attached. Meaning that the early vertebrae actually sit above the rib cage. Then there's a section of vertebrae that have ribs attached to them. And that is, you have 13 vertebrae that are going to have ribs attached to them since there are 13 ribs on each side. And then after vertebrae number 13, from there on to the tailbone, which is the end of the spinal column, You actually have vertebrae that have small wings coming off of them, but do not have ribs that are coming off of them. So they protect the spinal cord, but they're not protecting the internal organs. The major internal organs are protected by the rib cage. But the hind of the animal doesn't have any ribs. It has a spinal column to protect the spinal cord, but it does not have ribs around that area. So over there, you could have a vertebrae that's taken out without affecting ribs. So we do have a case where there's vertebrae missing and no ribs are missing. All right, so the Gemara says, Matkila Rav Hoshaya, Velitne Gabe Kulei Beit Shammai B'chumei Beit Hillel. Even though it's not really relevant to our Gemara, nevertheless, the Gemara is asking it because the outcome of the deal of Shmuel is that Beit Shammai turns out to be the Kula, which is that Beit Shammai now is saying in order for an animal to be a trefa, you need two vertebrae to be missing. Beit Hillel is saying that you only need one vertebrae to be missing. We have a list in Masechet Ediot of instances where Beit Shammai is the Kula and Beit Hillel is the Chumra. It's generally not the case. Therefore, the Mishnayot tell us all the exceptional cases where Beit Shammai is the Kula and not the Chumra. So over there, there's a machloket as to how many there are, and in the Tosefta, even additional items. And in none of those places is this one mentioned. This should have been one of the cases where Beit Shammai is the Kula, and no list mentions this as a Kula. Amalei Rav, so either Rav or the Gemara here, the alternate Kirsa, which probably makes more sense, is Amalei Rava. Rava answers the question and says, Ki itshel inyan tum'ah itshel. Tehavalo Beit Shammai l'chumra. That when the question was asked, it was asked with regards to tum'ah to ohel, which is where the Mishnah is found in all oath. Over there, Beit Shammai is the chumra. By tum'ah to ohel, Beit Hillel says one vertebrae is missing, there's no more longer tum'ah to ohel. On the other hand, Beit Shammai says you need two vertebrae to be missing for not to be tum'ah to ohel. Over there, Beit Shammai is the chumra, and Beit Hillel is the kula. That turns out to be, when it comes to trefa, just the opposite. But since the question or the original position was stated by tum'ah to ohel, over there, Beit Shammai is the chumra, and that's why it's not included in the list of Beit Shammai the kula. Now, begulgolet shenech besah beruba. In a case where you have a skull that is crushed over the majority of the area, shattered, or there have been severe blows to the head, right, Rav Yirmiya, rov govha, how do you measure the rov over here? Is it the rov of the height of the skull, or rov hekefa? Or is it the rov of the circumference of the skull? So Rashi over here says rov govha means minayinayim olamala, from the eye sockets upwards. That would be gova, and then the question would be rov of that, and rov hekefa would be the circumference of the skull, and Rashi says that the circumference is clearly bigger than the height of the skull from the eyes upward. What I think Rashi is saying is that from the eye sockets and upward, the skull starts to curve in, and that's the rov gova. That's the height. The height is from that point upward, and the circumference, seemingly for Rashi, would be measured at eye level, what the circumference around, and then you would measure a rov based on that. And Rashi says clearly the circumference is greater than the height. There's another view in the Rishonim. You can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom where he says, rov gova mi krum shamoach ad hapeh, from the membrane of the brain all the way down to the mouth of the animal. Rov hekefaz mi ozen ozen. It's from ear to ear. It's not even a full circumference. It's just a semicircle, half of the circumference of the animal, and clearly there, according to that opinion, it's just the opposite. Rov gova is bigger than rov hekefa. So that'd be machloket as to what the gova and the hekefa is over here. And the Gemara leaves it as a teku, as an unresolved issue, as to what the rov is to measure the type of damage that makes you into a trefa. And then the last of the statements of Shmuel, zu basar, v'chufa rov akares dirubo. This again we discuss when we discuss the keres apnimi and the keres achitzona. Over here, the Gemara is discussing it in the context of Shmuel. What's clear is that, and the Gemara is going to state this, and Tosfot has stated it a number of times, that Shmuel doesn't hold of that explanation in the Mishnah, because he has it as a trefa that's external to the Mishnah, not a part of the Mishnah. And that is Bairav Ashi, Berov Karua, or Berov Natul. When we say here that you have Rorov, that makes it into a trefa, does that mean that the underbelly, which has the Rov Akaris, that area, that underbelly, if a Rov of it is cut, that's a trefa? Or does it have to be missing? Literally, the flesh, that area has to be taken out in order for it to be a trefa. So Tishlet, let me do tonight. Why don't you answer from our Mishnah? Kares apnimit shenikva. The internal kares, single hole, makes it into a trefa. O shenikra rov achitzona. Or if the kares achitzona is ripped in the majority, karua, v'amre v'marova. And we saw in the one of the explanations for what the kares apnimi is, And the curse of Chitzonah was based on the Bnei Eretz Yisrael, Mishmei de Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Chanina, Kol HaKares Kulo, Zoi Kares HaPnimi. The entire rumen is called the Kares HaPnimi, and there if you have any hole in it, it is a treifa. We're choshesh for this shita la'alocha, and that's how we paskin, as Rashi says. V'zeu b'keres ha'chitzonah. So according to them, what's the keres ha'chitzonah? What's the outer rumen if the whole rumen has a din of a nekev? That's the keres ha'pnimi. Basar ha'chufa et rov ha'keres. That is the basar that covers over the majority of the rumen. It's called the keres ha'chitzonah, not because it's a keres, but because it covers. It's the outer layer that covers the rumen over there. That basar. So you see now in the Mishnah, it's telling you that Karas HaChitzonah, which according to Mei Rav means Basar HaChufet, Rova Karas, there it says Kriya is enough to make it into a Trefa. So that answers your question. Gemara says, that's not a good way to answer the question. Midu Taimel is Shmuel. The question is in the din of Shmuel. And Ach Amar Rav Yaakov Bar Nachmani Amar Shmuel, when it came to defining what the Karas HaPnimi is in the Karas HaChitzonah, Shmuel has a different view than the Bnei Marova. Makom Shein Bo Meilat. It's a place that doesn't have papillae on it. It's a place where they don't have those hair-like projectiles inside of the rumen. That's what's called the Karas HaPnimi. We saw one opinion that it's the roof of the rumen. The other one that it's the area that's close to where the esophagus enters into the rumen. That it doesn't have those projectiles over there. Or if they have them, they're much smaller in that area. They're not as big over there. Shmuel definitely has a different definition of what Karas HaPnimi and Karas HaChitzonah is. And so for him, Karas HaChitzonah is not a Basar HaChufet Rov HaKares. And so yeah, maybe they think, B'nai Marova, B'nai Eretz still think that's the case in the name of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, but that doesn't help us with regards to the din of Shmuel. Shmuel's din is coming out of the Zeh Klal at the end of the Mishnah. It's not one of the cases mentioned in the Mishnah, because Karas HaPnimi and Karas HaChitzonah, for him, Karas HaPnimi is where the rumen does not have the Meilat, and the Karas HaChitzonah is where it doesn't have the Meilat, but it's all the rumen itself. It's not speaking about the Basar HaChufet at the Rov HaKares. And therefore, for Shmuel, we don't have an answer as to what makes it into a trefa, whether it's simply a cut or you need natul. You actually need it to be missing. All right, now we move on to the next trefa that's mentioned in the Mishnah, which is drusat hazev. As we mentioned in the Mishnah, this is really the only trefa that's mentioned in the Torah, which is a basar basadeh, trefa lo tachelu, that you can't eat basar that was taruf, that was attacked in the wild. So this is a drusat hazev, which was mentioned in the Mishnah. Amar Rav, Yehuda Amar Rav. Now we have a qualification of Rav, or a statement of Rav, that seems to define something about the Mishnah. Bebehema min ha-ze'ev ulamala. When it comes to animals, then from a wolf and upwards is problematic. Ubo folt, and by birds, min ha-netz ulamala, it's from the hawk and upwards that it is a problem. So now what Rav seemingly is pointing out is that when it comes to making an animal a trefa, you need a large enough animal to make the other animal into a trefa. You have a small animal that attacks a larger animal, it's not going to make the larger animal into a trefa. And what he's saying is that when it comes to animals, you need a minimum an animal the size of a wolf in order to make it into a trefa. That's Rav's first statement. By animals, the minimum size of the attacking animal has to be a wolf. So if it's from a wolf and upwards, that can make the animal into a trefa. By birds, where you have birds of prey, that then attack other birds, so that has to be a bird that's, again, big enough to do damage. And there again, it's a hawk. Has to be the minimum size of an animal that will do that type of damage when it attacks. That's the minimum size of an animal. Anything above that size that's a bird of prey will create a trefa. Gemara says, L'mutei mai. What is Rav coming to exclude? Rav makes a statement. His statement gives you what it includes, doesn't tell you what it excludes. Ilaim l'mutei chatul. If you're telling me it's come to exclude a cat, tanina. That's already in the Mishnah. Udrusat hazev. The Mishnah mentions it's a wolf and not a cat. So if it's a wolf and not a cat, a cat's already excluded from the Mishnah. I don't need Rav to tell me to exclude it from the Mishnah. If you think it's coming to teach you that a ze'ev, a wolf, can even attack larger animals, and therefore from the Mishnah you would have thought that what the Mishnah is telling you is that in larger size animals, then from a wolf and bigger, is able to make something into a trefa. In the smaller animals, we don't know. We don't know what the din is by small animals. Maybe even a cat would have been included. Along comes Rav to tell you, by behema, zev is the cutoff. Whether it's a big animal or a small animal, zev, a wolf, is the cutoff. As Rashi explains over here, it's going to become clear in the Gemara, but the Gemara has a belief here. When the animal attacks its prey, it sinks its claws in there. The Gemara seems to assume when the claws are sunken into the animal, it deposits some sort of venom in the animal. And that venom is what makes the animal into a treifa. And so what Rashi, following that view of the Gemara, says is that animals from the wolf and vigor have sufficient venom in their claws to do damage to animals. But animals smaller than a wolf only have enough venom in there to damage birds, but not to damage animals. So even though they might have venom, it's just not efficacious enough to hurt the animal that they are depositing the venom into. So that may now, according to this, Gemara is asking, what did Rav add for us? So Gemara's first suggestion is that you would have thought that maybe wolf is defining by big animals what's the minimum size of animal that can attack larger animals. But by smaller animals, we don't know. And Rav comes to dispel that Havamina and say that by all animals, the wolf is the smallest animal that can attack. Only wolf and bigger are able to create a treifa. Although, if you look in the Bali and Tosafot, they suggest over here that, not like Rashi, that Rav's coming to clarify the Mishnah. Therefore, Rav's addition is to tell us that even by Behema Daka, there is still an exclusion of Chatul. Then the Bali and Tosafot say that the Chiddush of Rav is actually to tell us that Mizeven Amala means that the wolf has the capacity, even by Behemot Gasot, to be a Doreis. And not just an Ari, even a Ze'ev. And therefore, he's not coming to exclude a chatul. That was dealt with by the Mishnah. What he's coming to tell us, that the chiddush of the Mishnah is that Mizeven Amala applies to all behemoth across the board, big and small animals, and the more important chiddush is about the big animals. So that's how the other Rishonim learned this statement over here of the Gemara versus what Rashi says, that it's a clarification of why Rav needs to tell us information that we supposedly already knew from the Mishnah. Where it says, is that really true? But it's not. Don't we have in our Mishnah that Rav Yudah says, Drusa da zeiv b'daka, udrusa da ri b'gasa. They can't have a havamina like that because the zeiv is the minimum size for smaller animals that they're preying upon. Larger animals that they're preying upon, only a lion is the minimum size of an animal that can cause a treifa. So, if you tell me now that Rabbi Yehuda is arguing, the Tanakhama doesn't necessarily agree with that. And Rabbi Yehuda is arguing, v'ha amar Rabbi Binyamin bar Yafet, Amar Rabbi Elah, or probably Amar Rabbi Elazar, Lo bar Rabbi Yehuda l'lefaresh divrei chachamim. Over here, Rabbi Yehuda is not coming to argue on the chachamim, he's coming to qualify the statement of the chachamim. So now, what's the chiddush of Rav? If you tell me the chiddush of Rav is to tell you no cats, the Mishnah already tells you no cats. The Mishnah says, means zeiv alamala, from a wolf and upwards. So then the Gemara says, well, maybe you would add a havamina there, wolf and upwards is by bigger animals. But small animals, maybe even a chatul, and Rav comes to dispel it and says the M is the minimum for all types of animals. Where it says, how can you say that? Rabbi Yehuda right afterwards says that Zev is applicable by smaller animals and a lion by larger animals, which means that the Mishnah already told you, cat doesn't work by smaller animals. That, the Gemara says, Gavra Karami? You're making an assumption that Rabbi Yehuda qualifies the Chachamim. That's according to one Amora. According to Rav, maybe that's not the case. Maybe according to Rav, Rabbi Yehuda is arguing on the Chachamim. And therefore, Rav's coming to qualify the Chachamim statement and say that Zeb and the Malo applies to across the board. All animals is a Zeb and the Malo, and not just by large animals. And therefore, a cat is excluded completely. That's one answer. Ibai Dema, Dolam de Mute Chatul. In the end, it is coming to exclude a Chatul. Ma de Tema, Urcha de Milta, Tani. Then why does it mention wolves if it was going to include a cat as well? The Gemara says you would add a Havamina from the Mishnah, that the Mishnah mentions wolf because that's just the normal case. A normal toreif is a wolf. Cats in general are not torfim. They sometimes are toreif, but that's not their usual behavior. Zev, they come and attack the herds all the time. Common behavior there. So the Mishnah mentions a wolf, not because that's a threshold of the size of an animal, but just because that's the most common case. And you would have thought maybe even a chatul could be a matrif. The answer is, Kamash Malan, Rav says no, that's not just an example. It's exact. When it mentions wolf, it means wolf, and only from a wolf and bigger is there a treifa. So Neim Baitema, as Rashi notes, is coming to explain the position of the Chachamim in the Mishnah, that the Drusat Zeiv is Behema Daka, and in that way, the two Lishonot in the end actually end up saying something very similar, it's just a different way of presenting it. The other hand, according to the other Rishonim, where Rav in the previous case was saying that a Zeiv has the capacity to even be a Doreis with regards to larger animals, then the two Lashonot over here, there's a Machloket. According to the first Lashon, Rav says that a Ze'ev is even able, has the capacity to attack large animals like the Shita of the Chachamim. And there's no miut of Chatul from Behema Daka. And maybe even by Behema Daka, Chatul would have the capacity to attack. According to the second Teirutz, that Rabbi Huda is qualifying the position of the Chachamim, then the Drusat HaZeiv is then by Behema Daka, Dafka, and not by Behema Gasa, and then that would exclude a cat from doing any Drusa at all. According to those Rishonim, there's actually a machloket between the two Lishonot, whereas according to Rashi, both Lishonot come to the same conclusion. Amar of Amram, Amar of Chista. Now we have a statement from Chista. Drusat Chatul, Venimia, Bigdim Utlaim. That a cat and the way Rashi translates Nimiya over here is a marten, Bigdim Utlaim. They can attack the smallest of the small animals, which means a kid or a lamb, they can attack them and have an impact. Drusat Chuda, Bofot. And the Chuda says something, it's not clear what it is. Could be a weasel, could be a ferret, something along those lines. He says that they can create a drusa by Ofot, but not by the smaller animals. And obviously Rav Chisda doesn't argue on a Mishnah, he just said the Mishnah is speaking about larger size animals, and Rav Chisda himself is addressing the smaller animals, which is the gli and the telet, which is the kid and the lamb. So now you have gradations over here, according to Rav Chisda. You have, for instance, what would seemingly be the wolf in vigor, which can attack even larger sized animals. You have the chatul and nimiyah that can only attack the smallest of the animals. And then you have a chuda, which can only attack birds, even within animals. Animals that prey on other animals, that there is a gradation. So they can only attack certain sized animals. He's giving a gradation. Meitave. Is that really true, what Rav Chisda says? Drusat chatul, neitz v'nimiyah, ad shitinakev lachalau. And when it comes to the attack of a cat, a hawk, or a nimiyah, ad shitinakev lachalau. Until they reach into the internal part of the animal, there's no drusa. Aval drusa, leitlehu. They don't have a din of drusa. So what the Mishnah is saying, you can read it in one of two ways. The way Rashi reads it over here, their claws, or their attack is kukotz be'alma. It's just like putting a pin. It's like putting something sharp into the body. Therefore, they don't have impact until they puncture one of the internal organs. Once they puncture one of the internal organs, that's a regular trefa of a puncture of an internal organ. Nikei v'adakim, where you puncture the intestines, that's already a trefa. So they only make a trefa when they actually physically puncture the internal organs. So they don't have a din of drusa. They only have a din of puncturing like a needle, like some sort of sharp object. So Rashi thinks they don't have any din of drusa. They don't have any poison venom inside of them. And that's why their impact is only felt when they actually cut the animal. The Rambam, on the other hand, says that they also have venom, but it's a weaker venom. And therefore, for the venom to have an impact on the animal, it has to reach to the internal organs. By a wolf and a lion and all those bigger animals, simply by them grabbing the animal and sinking their claws in, even if they don't get to the internal organs, the venom from their claws is strong enough that it's going to make the animal into a trefa. But over here, since the venom is weaker in these animals, it needs to reach the chalal in order to have an impact. So that's the machlok of Rashi and the Rambam as to what it means that you have to reach the chalal. According to Rashi, means there's no venom here at all, and only if you puncture is it a problem. For the Rambam, it means you just need to get in deeper for your venom to have impact because your venom is much weaker than the bigger animals. So that's the ways to read it. But clearly, that braita that we just quoted is against what Rav Chisda said. Rav Chisda said that chatul and nimiyah have the ability to create a drusa, and even a chulda does. And yet this says, drusa chatul neitz v'nimiyah, achitina kev l'chalau, ab drusa leilu. Mar says, v'tizbara neitz lo doris. Wait a minute, how can you take that braita seriously? You're telling me a hawk is not doris? That's not. Our Mishnah says, drusa neitz. That the Mishnah tells us that a hawk does have a din of a drusa. Mar says, alokasha. That's not really an issue. Kan bofot, kan bigdim itlaim. Depends about what you're speaking about. In our Mishnah, the hawk is a doris. It's a bird of prey because it preys on other birds. So that's why it is a drusa. But in the braita that we quoted, the reason that Nate has no impact is because it's attacking animals. When it attacks animals, then it doesn't have a din of a drusa. But according to Rav Chisda, who says specifically by Gedim and Tlaim that a chatul and a nimiyah are doris, the braita is saying just the opposite. The braita is saying, despite the fact that these are Gedim and Tlaim, they don't have a din of drusa. And that's what the Gemara says. For Rav Chisda, it's still a problem. It says, Hudu Amar Ki Hai Tano. He holds like a different Tana. You're right, the Braita there is problematic for Rav Chisda, but we have another Braita, which Rav Chisda is basing his position on, and that is the Tanya Beribi. That we have a Braita, Beribi means the big one, the great Talmud Chacham. We don't know who it was, we just know that the Braita is quoting whoever that great Chacham was. Omer, Lo Amru, Ein Drusa, El Makom Ein Matzilin. The only time that we say that there isn't a Drusa for these animals is where there is no way to save the victim. Aval Makom Sheish Matzilim, Yesh Drusa. On the other hand, if there is someone saving the victim or the prey from the one who's attacking, then there is a drusa. So what the suggestion of the Braita is that, for instance, if you have a cat attacks the glian tolet, he might scratch it, he might injure them, but he doesn't create this problem of drusa, which is the insertion of that venom into the animal. On the other hand, if someone comes and saves the herd from the cat, chases away the cat, blocks him from getting to his prey, he gets angry. And when he gets angry, that increases the venom or the potency of the venom and upgrades his venom to the point where it can be a drusa. The Gemara is viewing the venom here in the claws of the animals similar to the way of a snake. A snake, when it's calm and it's not provoked, in general won't do anything. But a snake that is provoked gets angry and then it goes and attacks its prey or goes after its prey and inserts the venom. So a similar idea over here by the cat. The cat's just working in its normal function. Yes, it attacks, it scratches, but those scratches are not considered to be a drusa that has venom. But if you protect the prey from the cat and chase it away a couple of times, it gets angrier and angrier, and as it gets angrier, it builds up the venom inside of it, and therefore when it claws now, that deposit of venom is going to be much more potent than the normal clawing of the cat. So that'd be the solution now, and therefore Rav Chisda is following this opinion, which means that the Braita is going to be authored by the Rabbanon, who argue on this Berebi, and they believe that there's never venom in a cat, no matter whether you save it or don't save it. So the Braita before is going to be authored by the Chachamim, who believe that a Chatul never has a din of drusa, never has that venom in its claws. Rav Chisda is going to follow Beribi and say that there are instances where it has that potency, when you try to save the prey or you protect the prey from the attack. And in that case, it's going to get angry and it will have a din of drusa, at least with Gedim, it's La'im, at least with smaller animals. And that'll be the distinction. And Rav Chisda then would still be, again, in concert with the Mishnah, and he'll say, our Mishnah is only talking about larger animals, not the smaller animals. Now the Gemara questions, Umakom she'en matzilim ein drusa. Is that really true when you don't save something from the attacker? It doesn't have this potency of venom in its claws. V'ayitarna golet, dave bei Rav Kana. There was this chicken in the house of Rav Kana. The Rahat Chatul Batra. There's a cat that was chasing down the chicken. Ba'ali Idrona. It jumped into the room. It went into a room, internal room. Idache Dasha Ba'pe. And not intentionally, but because of all the fluttering and all the movement of the chicken, by accident or by serendipity, it happened to close the door of the room that it went into. So it ended up protecting itself by running away and then having the door closed. And leave the cat on the outside and the chicken on the inside. And the cat, out of its anger, went ahead and clawed the door. And when they went to look at the door where the claw print was, the scratches from the claw of the cat, there were five little drops of dam over there, which the Gemara seemingly thinks is connected with this idea of the deposit that happens when the claws go in. That blood was the deposit it makes of the venom that it would have put into the animal. So over there you see that nobody saved the chicken over there. Nobody intervened to protect the chicken. And yet the cat is still swiping the door and depositing venom out of anger. It says, when the chicken saved itself, it's like it saved somebody else intervening. The cat doesn't understand that when you close the door, that blocks him from the chicken. Or if the chicken closes the door and it blocks him from getting the chicken. Either way, he's angry because the chicken got away. When he's angry, he becomes a dores and he deposits the venom there. Rabbanon, and the Rabbanon who argue on Ribi, he held, Zahira Itle, Falo Kali Ziare. How do they answer? How do they explain this incident with the cat where there was blood on the door? That seems to indicate that they're right. There is venom there. So the answer is that they believe there is venom, but the venom is just not strong enough. So there is venom in those types of cases, maybe only in the cases where it gets angry, but the venom never reaches a level of potency where it's going to be a problem. This sounds more along the lines of the Rambam, that these animals that don't have a din of drusa still deposit poison, it's just not effective. And that's what the Chachamim are saying. It's just not potent enough to make a difference. Now, with regards to the venom, even though we know today that that doesn't exist in the claws of the animals, there's no such thing as venom, they can't deposit venom and they don't poison other animals. Nevertheless, it is true that the claws of animals, especially animals that prey on other animals and then have meat or dead meat in their nails, there is a tremendous amount of bacteria and deleterious bacteria that grows and sits under the nails of those animals. And therefore, when the animal attacks, it may not be depositing venom, it might be depositing some bacteria that would then cause a animal to deteriorate or to get sick or ill or become a trepha. So the truth is that the outcome might be the equivalent of what would happen with venom. The Gemara almost clearly, in the way Rashi explains it, seems to think there is some sort of liquid or deposit that's made by the animal, especially by the example given here by the cat. But nevertheless, what they're saying might be true, but not for the reason that they're saying. It might be true, not because it's venom or ZRA that's deposited, but because of the deleterious bacterial buildup that's on the claws of animals, especially animals that are preying on meat and dead meat, then that type of cut will deposit the bacteria into the bloodstream of the animal, and that's what could cause this problem that simulates the effect of venom and makes the animal into a trepha. So that's one way to answer. The other answer is, Iga de Amre. There's some that suggest, Hamani Beribihi. That Breita is Beribi. The Tanya, Beribi Omer, Lo Amru Yesh Drusa, L'makom Sheyesh Matzilin. That the only time that the cat has a den of venom and a drusa is when somebody saves or blocks him from getting to his prey. But makom sheim matzilim ain't drusa. In a place where nobody saves it, it's not a drusa. Ub makom sheim matzilim ain't drusa. Is that really true that in a place where there's nobody that saves it, that there isn't a drusa? Ba'ai tarnagola, davi bei Rav Kana, the chicken in the house of Rav Kana, the rod, katul batra, is being chased by a cat. Ba'ali drone, ran into a room, itache dasha bape, and by accident it closed the door on the cat and protected itself. Ma'ai ladasha besukufe, and then he clawed the door with his claw. Vishtachalei chamisha kurtei dama. And over there, you had five deposits of blood on there. The Gemara says, Atzalat atzma, namikat atzalat acherim damya. When the chicken saves itself, it's like someone else intervening on behalf of the chicken, and the cat gets angry, and that's why there was venom over there. Now, as Rashi explains over here, in this instance, the Braita is authored by Ribi. That means that the Braita, which says that a chatul, don't have a din of a dores, that's in a case where nobody saved them. It's a case where nobody saved them. And in a case where somebody did save them, then there would be a din of a drusa. On the other hand, Rav Chista says that a nimi and a chatul have a din of drusa all the time, even when they're not being saved, he's going to hold like the Rabbanan. And in this Ikadamri, as Rashi points out, the Rabbanan are the opposite. Before we said the Rabbanan believe there's no venom in a cat at all. That's how they argue on Ribi. Ribi says there is sometimes, and the Rabbanan said there's never any venom. On the other hand, in this version, they argue on Ribi and say that they always have venom. They always are dores. And they disagree with Rabbi from the other perspective. Over here, the Rabbanan are more machmir. And they say that whether its prey was saved from it or not saved from it, it will deposit venom. And then Rav Chista is holding like the Rabbanan in that case. And then obviously the explanation of our Mishnah will be as the ape is speaking about a wolf because it's speaking about larger animals. And by larger animals, not a di and its leh, they are only a wolf as a din of a drusa. But in the smaller animals, there is a din of drusa, maybe even according to our Mishnah. And that's Rav Chista's view, which is in concert with the view of the Rabbanan. And the Braita that says that there isn't is speaking in the position of Ribi in a case where there was nobody saving the prey from the attack. So, Bamine Rav Kana Mei Rav. So, Rav Kana, again, is a Talmid of Rav, who we saw earlier, asked the question of Rav here again. Yesh drusa lechatul, or ain't drusa lechatul? Does a cat have a din of drusa, or does it not have a din of drusa? Amblei, after chuda yesh drusa. Why are you asking me about a cat? Even a weasel, which is smaller, has a din of drusa. Yesh drusa lechuda. Then he asked him, does a weasel have a din of a drusa? Or ain't le drusa? Or ain't drusa lechuda, or does it not have a din of drusa? Why are you asking me about a weasel? Even a cat doesn't have a din of a drusa. So now he asks him, Yesh lehem trusa or ein lehem trusa. So then when he asks them both together, he says, do I, can and a weasel have a din of trusa? He says that a cat does have a din of trusa, chuda does not have a din of trusa. The Gemara says, v'lo kasha. Seems like he has a stira here. He has three different opinions. In one case, he says that a chatul and a weasel have a din of trusa. In one case, he says a chatul and a chuda do not have a din of trusa. And in one case, he says their din is split. In the case where he says even a weasel has a din of trusa, both fault. That's if they're attacking birds. When they're attacking birds, both a cat and a weasel have a din of trusa. Where he said that even a cat does not have a din of trusa is imrei rav ravei. That's in the larger animals, then a cat and a chuda have no impact. In the case where he gave a split decision, which was the chatul yesh trusa, the chuda ain't trusa, that the cat does have a trusa, but the chuda, the weasel, does not have a trusa, big de'im utvayim. That's with the smaller animals, that's the kids and the lambs. There, the chatul does have a din of trusa, and the chuda does not. Tosfot over here says it's a strange way to deal with this. The first thing Tosfot says is that these were asked in different contexts. Meaning that he asked this question. Rav was speaking about birds, and Rav Gana posed the question. Rav was speaking about animals, and he posed the question. And Rav was speaking about small animals, and he posed the question. So the context in each of those cases gave the answer, explained why Rav had a different din in each of these cases. And what the Gemara is answering is, this is the context in which these were said. Rav Gana, we're just listing all these out. But the questions were actually asked at different times, and the different times they were asked were a different context. And the answer is, I'm going to give you context now to all of these statements that we heard in the name of Rav Gana from Rav. And then the Tosfot backs away and says, maybe, Yesh Tavar D'chol HaNachav U'Pamachat. Maybe it was all at once. And B'tchilo Shalu Yesh Trusa L'Chatul Olav. And he began to ask him the questions, and Rav gave him almost like a wise guy type of answer, which helped him to learn the whole sugya, which is that Shalu Yesh Trusa L'Chatul Olav. He does a chatul have a trusa or not? And he says, why are you're asking me, Stam? In Stam, even a chuda has a trusa. So then he asked him, if a chuda has a trusa in all places, and he says, even a cat sometimes doesn't have a din of trusa. So then he says to him, okay, explain to me, if this is a trusa and that's a trusa, it's not, and yes it is, when it is and when it isn't. And then he went on to explain and give him the breakdown. So there are two different ways to understand how the questions were posed, whether it were in separate occasions, and that's why the answer is that it's different context, or it was in one occasion, and it was a progressive type of questioning, which is asking about one item, and Rabbi, well, if you're asking about a chuda, you should be asking about a chatul. If you're asking about a chatul, maybe you should worry about a chuda as well. And then finally get to the answer, which is, there are differences between them, and the differences have to do with the context or the size of the prey that we're speaking about. Okay, we're going to stop here, 9 lines down on the top of Gimel Amud Aleph.